Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is Head of Marketing for Ecovax, Christopher Kane. Christopher, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Appreciate you having me.
You are currently the Head of Marketing for Ecovax Robotics. As it's said, the fastest growing global brand in robotic vacuums. We'll get into that. Previously, you were led marketing campaigns for companies such as Sun Microsystems, Cisco, Informix, and NEC.
If you saw an ad during the internet bubble for a technology company and it had a pet in it or an animal, that was probably me, and I apologize.
All right, apologies accepted. Before we get into the meat of the show, because this is kind of an unusual topic, maybe a little bit for the listeners, tell me about Ecovax briefly, like what the company is and what it does and its products, and then we're going to get into your background, and then we'll get into some of those other things we talked about, IoT and all that good jazz. So what about Ecovax?
I appreciate it. So
longer than elevator speech, but
longer than elevator. Very tall building, extended elevator ride. Little kid has hit all the buttons on the elevator, so it's going to take a while. So Ecovax Robotics, as you mentioned, is a robotics company based in China, but we have a division here in the U.S. And the background of the company is actually robotics and AI. They've had industrial robotics, hospitality robots back in China. So robots in space is kind of the thing we do. And so not surprisingly, when they started to look in the U.S. and where was a good entrance for the company and its technology and its expertise, they decided on robotic vacuum cleaners, which really are little tiny robots that are becoming smarter and smarter every day. So we launched our new line of robotic vacuums led by the R95 D-Bot in June of this year. You can find those at most online retailers, and we'll be making more announcements at CES. But the goal was to take...
I think Jeff Gamet has one. I think one of your colleagues sent him one for a review.
Yeah, we did, and they're really great because they've come a long ways. I mean, you know, the first generation they were not terribly smart. They were very cool toys that sometimes were adequate as vacuums. But the current generation of robotic vacuums are really quite powerful. And you kind of mentioned IoT in the introduction, and it's kind of fun to think of these things because they're not just robotic vacuums. These are actually highly mobile, highly intelligent IoT nodes that are loose in an environment called your home. And so there's lots of things you can do today and tomorrow, and it's going to be a very interesting part of the market to watch.
Excellent. Well, tell me, how did you get into this business? You have an interesting background to tell me about.
Yeah, I was one of those lucky people. My first summer job, I immediately fell in love with the industry. I was a summer intern at Atari, and just kind of fell in love with marketing, fell in love with technology.
Well, didn't Steve Jobs do that? Wasn't his first job Atari?
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of us, you know, and Nolan Bushnell and lots of people kind of were born in the crucible of Atari. And I just knew that's what I wanted to do. And I have an English major and a computer science minor. So I'm not good enough to be an engineer, but I'm pretty good at translating. So I wound up in marketing. And
tell me the PDP-11 story in high school.
Oh, you had to bring that up.
I had to.
You had to. Okay. So, of course, being a hacker when I was younger, I was in high school. And this is the late 70s, early 80s. And if you're a hacker in high school, you're inevitably building a text-based adventure game of some sort. And mine was a World War II. So, you know, you're in Belgium. You come to a fork in the road. Do you turn left or turn right? Oh, there's a King Tiger tank on the right-hand side. What do you use? Your grenade, your bazooka. And I quickly...
On a Tiger tank?
That didn't work very well. The bazooka, by the way, the bazooka is the right answer. We were time sharing, you know, and I was running out of time on my account because I was building a game instead of doing my work. And I decided to hack my account and give myself more hours. And the problem with being a hacker at 16 is you're all skill but no subtlety. So I, you know, I exceeded the field length. I believe it was a two-digit field, and of course I put in three digits. But this is what you do when you're 16, right? Instead of making your account 40 hours instead of 20 hours, you make it 400 hours. Because you're just not terribly subtle. That, of course, created an overflow. I got busted immediately. So, yeah, that wasn't a terribly successful hack.
So tell me about when you went on after college to Paramount.
Yeah, so it was an
issue. Paramount. That's fascinating.
Well, you get a job during the days of, as not to bring up an old cliche that is going to make everyone listening to the show burst into tears. But at one point, there was this concept of Sillywood, that Silicon Valley and Hollywood were going to mash together. This is why Terry Semel winds up getting hired as the head of Yahoo. And Paramount, we had a little group in Santa Clara called Computer Curriculum Corporation. It was you know, Paramount's really a holding company. So it's not just Paramount Studios. It was also Simon Schuster, Madison Square Garden, and this weird little technology company called Computer Curriculum Corporation that did big integrate. Yeah, they did integrated learning systems. So if you go into a high school and there's 40 computers set up in the lab, that's either Jostens or CCC. And because we were the only real technology unit within the umbrella of Paramount, as Sillywood in this intersection, and oh God, I'm going to use the word synergy, between Hollywood and Silicon Valley was supposedly happening, we started getting more and more groups within Paramount calling us, because we were the only technology people, and we're like, we don't really do that, we're school systems, but thanks for asking. And it got to the point where we kind of jokingly put together a business plan for something called the Paramount Technology Group that would become the technology hub for all of Paramount and all its subsidiaries. And we shipped off this proposal with, I believe at the time, a $40 million budget, laughed hysterically to ourselves, and went back to our work. Damned if they didn't approve it.
Wow.
So we started on Hanson Way in Palo Alto, right across from HP. We started the Paramount Technology Group, and we were involved in the beginning phases of really interactive programming, really cool interactive games that were being done. This is also the first
technical support for production, like Star Trek.
I was not. I was doing a strategy and marketing, and we were also doing interactive television, because that was the very beginning of interactive television.
So
as
that's
well.
How you got into marketing, so to speak.
That's how I got into marketing. So that became my sort of big ticket, big marketing, and then so we knew we were going to get shut down by Viacom, and we basically a group of us went to a startup together, kind of a Adwater Instant Management team, and went for a couple startups, did a couple work on the agency side. I've always kind of bounced back and forth between the client side and the agency side. And the last stop sort of on the agency / media was prior to Ecovacs. I was the publisher at ReadWrite. And ReadWrite obviously is a big IoT platform. And that's how Ecovacs found out about me.
Connections.
Yes, all about connections. So it's been interesting, because a lot of the problems that we saw at ReadWrite that we felt were holding back the connected home are problems I now get to try and solve at Ecovacs. So it's kind of fun.
Awesome. So we had a great discussion last week about security and the philosophy of the company. So as you told me, ReadWrite sort of took ownership of the IoT communication to the world, and you carried that over, it seems.
Well, it was a very similar thing, which is when we got to ReadWrite and we relaunched it around IoT, we realized that the glue that was going to hold all this stuff together, the promise of the connected world, the fuel for that is data. But what was holding back data was an antiquated approach towards security and how security works, and we basically are trying to take security, perimeter-based security like we've known for 40 years, and try and force-feed it into the world of IoT. That's just frankly not working. I was just at the Smart Home Summit conference yesterday on a panel, and we were talking about what people should expect from the connected home in the near future, and what is holding it back from that. And not surprisingly, almost the entire conversation was around data and security and rights and identity, and how do we solve all this in order to really power this connected world, because it's a contradiction in terms, right? In order for the connected world to really flourish, the data has to be free. But security, as we know it, is about trapping data and putting it in a box. And those things are inherently conflicted. So it's a challenge that we saw at ReadWrite, and it's also a challenge that we're addressing at Ecovacs.
I think one of those challenges that was flunked recently was by one of your competitors, the president of iRobot, about a month ago. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it was a couple of months ago, and he gave an interview and said that one of the things they were looking to do was to sell the maps of their customers' homes to third-party marketing folks.
OMG.
Yeah, this was not well received, I guess, is the nice way to put it. People melted down is another way to put it. So he announced this on a Monday. The internet goes crazy. We're actually getting interviews with magazines. I'm quoted in USA Today, basically saying, nope, that is the wrong way to go about this. And by Friday, he had to walk it back and do the old I was misunderstood approach. But you're seeing this happening a lot because you have companies that are consumer companies who want to be in the data business, but are not taking the responsibility of that. And, yeah, and another example,
he didn't understand his business model.
And that the model, I mean, the thing about IoT is it's not just a technology change. It's a business model change. You're changing your relationship with the world around you. You know, for 40 years, we've sold technology the same way, which is I'm going to sell you a product or a service. And if you want to keep having a relationship with me, I'll sell you a service contract or a warranty. And those have always been two completely different things. The problem with these connected devices is you're in the relationship business on day one, whether you want to be or not. And that's a challenge. Look what happened to Mattel. So Mattel launches this Wi-Fi Barbie a couple of years ago. Great idea. The problem is they stored your Wi-Fi password unencrypted in plain text. And of course, they immediately get hacked. I try to explain to people that that didn't happen because of a technology failure. The technology failed, but it didn't happen because of a technology failure. It happened because Mattel didn't realize the second they shipped that first Wi-Fi Barbie, they were no longer a toy company. They were a data company that sells toys.
That was an amazing insight. I loved that when you told me about that at first.
That yeah, and that's the responsibility. You own that, whether you want to or not. And even if you can't figure out a way to monetize it or charge it, tough, too bad, you own it.
Tell me about how Ecovacs solves some of those problems, like the technical architecture,
yeah, so,
how you
so,
store your data, how you navigate.
Absolutely. It's a great question. And because our background is in industrial and hospitality robotics, we've worked with large companies who don't like it when you screw around with their data. So we're a lot more hardcore about our data and what we do with it than other companies are. It's kind of a weird thing. I'm working for a Chinese company that's more strict with its data policies than some of our U.S. competitors, which is a little strange.
Do you get pushback from customers who don't understand that and they just have a first gut reaction to a Chinese company and say, oh my.
Oh my, it's going to China. So the first thing we tell them is none of our customer data goes to China. It actually stays on a server here in the U.S. But more importantly, we've architected our products end-to-end to be very tough. We have encryption on our bots. So we are storing stuff encrypted. We're not leaving your password unencrypted in plain text. The maps we know are people are extremely sensitive to the fact that there is now a representation of the floor plan of their house. That is a really scary thing. Our maps,
in concert with an IP address and your location.
Exactly. So guess what we do with those maps? They stay on the customer's phone. We do not send those to the cloud.
Do you support Android and iOS?
We do. And so those maps do not get turned loose even to us. And that's how we sort of, the other thing we
like
do,
Apple, we don't know what your house looks like and we don't care.
and honestly, for our purposes, it's more important that the bots understand what's going on than we do. The other thing
that's
is
an important, that's cool. I like that. The bot needs to understand that you don't. That sounds like Tim Cook, if I may say so.
Well, thank you. The other thing is the mapping. The mapping, how we get the mapping is very scary for people because most of our competitors use a camera. And they use it's kind of a cheaper but a little sloppier way to build mapping. The problem with that is it's a camera. It's a mobile camera that's loose in your home. And sure enough, about 3 weeks ago, LG figured out how you could hack one of their cameras. You can't hack our cameras because there isn't one. We use laser-based navigation. So in essence, it's a little version, a miniature version of LiDAR, the laser system that's used on autonomous cars. So it's actually a laser that scans your floor, scans where the tables are, where the legs of the sofa is, so it understands what the obstructions are down at its level.
Jeff Ganna told me about how his EcoVax was going up against the edge of the steps, and he couldn't wait to see whether it would fall overboard on the steps.
Nope.
And it went up to the edge, and it did a little motion, and it did a little jiggle, and it's kind of like roamed around the edge of the, walked back and forth along the stair step. And said, I know where this stair step is now.
Exactly. It defines it. It maps it out. And it knows where it is from that point forward. And the nice thing about that, too, is because we use laser-based, what's called SLAM, our navigation technology, it's a very, very accurate. So we can do things like that. And then we can also build other capabilities on top of it, like virtual boundaries.
What about the timing of that? You've got LiDAR. You don't have to do photographic or camera recognition, which is complex. Nope. But at least it's not distance-based. But it's speed of light. You know, light travels 1 foot in 1 nanosecond. So if you're trying to figure out where something is that's 6 inches away, you got to have some very fast electronics, do you not?
We do. It's funny. We were talking to a Benny Evangelista from the Chronicle, and you know, these really are becoming, if you think about the sensors to keep them from going off the steps, if you think about the LiDAR, if you think about the mapping technology, these are kind of becoming almost little tiny autonomous cars that are loose in your house. There's quite a lot of technology and firepower that is in there. That's why I tell people, too. I said, look, if you've had a bad experience 3 or 4 years ago with a robotic vacuum, I would encourage you to revisit it because these are not the same products anymore.
Did you start off evolving in that version one like we were a few years ago, or are you relatively recent to the game?
Well, we've been around for selling in China for 4 years. We've only recently come to the U.S. And we talk about our current mapping products being third-generation robotic vacuums. Okay. And we say that they've really gone through. So the first generation was rules-based. So you got a fixed set of rules. If something happens, then do this. You know, a bunch of logic circuits, basically. So if you hit an obstruction, turn right 10 degrees. If you hit it again, turn right 10 degrees again. You know, do that until you're clear and then keep vacuuming. And it's very random. Two problems with it is it doesn't hit your entire floor because it's kind of a random cleaning pattern. There's no context to the cleaning. It's just rattling through a set of rules. And the second thing is all of these robotic vacuums, regardless of manufacturer, us included, have really small batteries in them. So the problem with being random and inefficient is you get all those Facebook photos and YouTube videos of bots dying in the middle of people's rooms because they run out of energy and they can't get back to their dock. So that's not great. It's not cleaning great. It's running out of power. Bad experience all around. Second generation are algorithm-based. So now we're getting more intelligent about our environment. We're starting algorithm-based robots basically try to vacuum like a human would. So that's when you start seeing long sort of lawnmower paths that the robot is taking back and forth. It tries to complete circuits. You know, it tries to vacuum like you and I would. You know, vacuum as far as you can, then turn around and go back like you're a lawnmower. Those are better. They still have a tendency to run on power, but you're getting a far better cleaning experience. With that, you are getting a much better coverage. So those are dramatically better. The third generation is where you take those algorithms and then you enhance them with the mapping. You give those algorithms context now for the environment that they're in and then build efficiencies on top of that. The first time I ran our current product through my apartment here in San Francisco, it took it about 50 minutes to map it out and figure out what was in it. Once it had figured that out, it takes it 35 minutes to clean it. Because it's now optimizing its algorithms based on the context of I now have a map of this environment and I can be smarter about it.
Excellent. Well, I think it's time to take a break real quick. That's a great story. I want to talk to you some more about some of the things that we discussed previously. But first, it's time for a break. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/AppleStore, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm chatting with Head of Marketing for Ecovacs, Christopher Kane. So you mentioned last week when we were talking about how these modern third technology robots sit for a long time charging, not doing anything. They're only vacuuming about 10% of their life. And you gave me some tantalizing glimpses about what might be coming. Are you ready to talk about even a glimmer of what's going on?
Well, I can certainly talk about it in broad purposes. I mean, we are, of course, 45 days away from a little tiny coffee klatch called CES, and there'll be more there. But yeah, these are, if you step back and realize that these are IoT nodes that are loose in your house and they provide context, they can provide context for other products and services as well. Again, I was at the Smart Home Summit yesterday and on a panel, and the word context kept coming up, because right now what you have is you have a bunch of smart home products who aren't really aware of each other, who kind of keep their data to themselves, and you don't really wind up with a smart home. You wind up with a very needy home, right? You wind up with a home that demands more of your attention and your time if you've got
too many spinning plates.
Too many spinning plates. Every device is going to drop an app on your phone, and you're going to sit there whacking away at interfaces for the rest of your natural born life. And Amazon Alexa and Google Home are making this better, but there's still what I call the difference between a reactive home and a responsive home. A responsive home is one that sits there and waits to respond to your requests. So whether you're doing it through an app or through Amazon Alexa, it's still the same inherent problem, in that you're not going to do anything until I tell you to do something. I think it's ridiculous that we have something called a smart light bulb, and yet if I go into my office and realize I left the smart light bulb on, I have to fire up an app and tell the smart light bulb to turn itself off. That doesn't seem terribly smart.
Or you could say, Alexa, turn off the lights in this room.
Not if you're at the office, you can't. And the problem there is, you know, you want a home where the light bulb can talk to the front door, and the front door can say, oh, by the way, John just left. The light bulb went, ah, great, he forgot to turn me off. I'll turn myself off. Once they start talking to each other and there's a context, there's a way to hold this all together, then these things start becoming more powerful. Then you move from being a responsive home to being a reactive home. It just reacts to the situations that it sees in front of its own nose. It can take care of itself. I don't know. It puts the smart back in smart home. And one of the things I really love about our mapping technology, and that we have a device loose within the context of a thing called a map, is we can provide context and connectivity to other devices that are within that home as well.
Does that mean that the Ecovacs might use its LiDAR to figure out whether you're walking around in the room or not?
Or it can use other sensors. That wind up doesn't just have to be the LiDAR. It could be other sensors and other applications and other microservices you could figure out that you could put on top of that thing or integrate into it. I think these are going to become very powerful devices. We always talk about, we've been promised Rosie, you know, from the Jetsons. Where's Rosie?
Yeah. Well, that's my next question.
Yeah, I think these bots have a chance to be, maybe we think of Rosie, you know, looking like humans, but Rosie could just be a very small, very smart object that spends 10% of its time being a vacuum.
Well, we talked before about how Ecovacs has a hospitality robot called Benabot.
Mm-hmm.
Do you foresee a marriage of a Benabot and an Ecovacs vacuum to the point where you have a Rosie that could, you know, like pick up socks and put them in the laundry basket and do dishes? And
I think, you know, once you get into mechanical aspirations, the difficulty of landing that jump get a lot higher. But I think that the first generation is really going to be about taking an object that can be, in essence, your digital twin, as GE would say in industrial IoT, that would be your digital twin within your home environment and can help respond and act to situations while you're not there. And I think that's where you see the first generation of these devices happening. There's a lot of firepower, and there's a lot of benefits that can be gained very quickly in that environment. And I think that's where you'll see the sort of that first generation of smart, not in the devices themselves becoming dramatically smarter overnight, but in their ability to interact with each other becoming smarter.
One of the things we talked about before also was engendering trust. This is a great opportunity for your company to, by its design, earn the trust of the customer and then leverage that into future products. Something that Apple has done quite well.
Yeah, trust is really important because, look, there's a hype curve to risk, just like there's a hype curve to new technology. You think about, can you remember the first time you entered your credit card onto a website? That was a terrifying experience.
Yes, it was.
Now, Amazon knows every last thing about us, so we can hit that one button and buy that thing we want. I mean, think how quickly we went from stage one to stage two there. And part of that, what fueled that was trust, that we inherently trust Amazon. So
I'd love to take a tour of Amazon's data center and see their security systems.
Yeah, I'm sure no one is allowed to go in. But think how quickly that inherent risk of no one has ever put their credit card onto a website, how quickly we went from there to one button. And so you have a risk-reward ratio, which is built on trust versus benefit. How much do I trust you, and what benefit am I extracting back from this? And if that winds up being a plus number, you move forward. If it winds up being a negative sign, you move back. It's part of the reason why I think you look at the different verticals in IoT right now, and the one that currently seems to be the furthest back is health, because everything that terrifies us about privacy and data and security is magnified when we're talking about health.
Especially when we're talking about hospitals who screw up and get victimized by ransomware.
Absolutely. But when that trust and that benefit get fixed in health, I argue that over the next 5 years, the most accretive value that'll be unlocked by IoT will be in health. But it's like a rubber band right now. It's being pulled back. It's getting further behind everyone. But the second it lets go, we hit that trust benefit, that number goes positive, that thing is going to take off. But trust is important. And I worked for a branding agency for years. And our founder, Jamie Capozzi, he used to say that brands obey gravity. And what he meant by that was you have to do 10 things correctly for your level of trust to go up one step in the eye of a consumer, but you only have to do one wrong thing to go down 10.
Do you think companies are spending enough money? Do you think executives at big companies have enough technical expertise to allocate funds to do their security properly? It seems to me, from all these breaches we've been hearing about, you know, Equifax and Yahoo and Kohl's and Target,
yep,
companies are not taking it seriously, or are they just not keeping up with the bad guys, or with races too tough?
Well, I think they are taking it seriously. There is certainly a lot of money. You see this new role called the CISO that's sort of appeared in the last couple of years. So I think they're taking seriously. The problems, I think they're not being given a knife at a gunfight. They've been given a thumbtack. And the problem is how they're approaching security is fundamentally incorrect. And
tell me about
the problem. Well, you still go to these security shows and people are talking about perimeter-based defense, which is just insane. We can't go from millions of PCs to billions of mobile phones to trillions of nodes. And really, whether it's a phone, a TV, a car, an airplane, they're all just nodes now in the world of IoT, to trillions of nodes, and think you can lock every door. It's just fundamentally not going to happen. There's an old joke in IT security that the CIO has to be right every time, a hacker only has to be right once. The numbers are not in your benefit. And the bigger problem is, because it's still this old model of keeping people out, once they get in, it's ridiculous what people can pull off. You mentioned Target. So someone hacks their way in through an AC system. Okay, so you forgot a node. Topology is an issue for network security, mm-hmm. understanding what is actually hooked up to your network and what's actually hanging off it. Most companies, if you go to them and you ask them to do an audit of their topology, they'll wind up missing a bunch of stuff or find a bunch of stuff they forgot was hanging off their network. The problem, the real crime, was not that someone got into Target's network through an AC unit. The crime was they were able to then traverse and traipse their way right into the POS system.
So the architecture
world is that allowed?
Is right. important, right? So how you construct your architecture, your databases, your links and your firewalls, so you have a sort of a layered defense?
It has to be a layered defense because the reality is, and this still makes people's heads explode, but it shouldn't, is the reality of security right now for corporations is they're going to get in. And before you sort of start rejiggering your security and your approach to this new world, you have to come to grips with that. They're going to get in. The old joke at Black Hat, the unofficial slogan of Black Hat is there's two kinds of companies in the world, those that have been hacked and those that don't know they've been hacked. They're going to get in. And it's there are still so many CIOs that think it's still the guns on the wall. We're going to keep the barbarians out. The barbarians are going to get in. Just take a deep breath, suck it up, agree to this, and then start looking at how you build that layered defense. You know, how you start building honeypots and AI and becoming more dynamic in how you monitor
and front room trapdoors. I've heard about where the guy thinks he's in. And you get a chance to size him up while he rummages around, and he thinks he's in, but he's not.
It's the old honeypot trick. But you're going to have to start. Jason Boswell from Ericsson says that we have to get out of an infiltration mindset and get into an exfiltration mindset. It's not if they're going to get in. It's if they can get it out. And the metaphor he uses is a car dealership.
Oh, speaking of getting it out. Yeah, I wondered about that. So
yeah,
so we hear about Equifax, somebody grabbing 145 million data records. How can you build a system where you don't sense the flow of 145 gigabytes of data being flowing out of your system?
Exactly. That is insane. What Jason says is he goes, look, if you own a car dealership and someone breaks into your car dealership, but they can't find the keys to the cars, do you care? I mean, it's an inconvenience. Sure, they knock over the ficus, they steal the coffee machine. But if they can't get the cars out,
or if all the keys are on the same board and they drive away with 15 Ferraris instead of one,
that's a problem. But you know, his point is, you know, don't worry about they're going to get in. They're going to get in. Worry about keeping them from getting out or bringing stuff with them. And to your point, how can you push that much data out of Equifax and not have a red flag go off in the network somewhere?
I know. Is there something a consumer can do to sort of complement or assist with this kind of layer defense, like minimizing your footprint and your profile? You talked with me last week about financial challenge data and stuff like that.
Exactly. The reality is we can, but I have two problems with that. Problem number one, any security architecture that requires us to be our own CIO is doomed to failure. And the reason for that is the second thing, which is we're all terrible at it. The example I always give is I was speaking at a conference, and inevitably when I speak about data, someone brings up a question about who owns the data. And the answer I always give is nobody. And it's a zero trust model is where you need to start. And that terrifies people. But then I tell them, I said, look, let me explain something to you. I said, how many of you, raise your hand if you've answered one of those Facebook quizzes where it's, you know, my stripper name is my high school I went to and the name of my first girlfriend, or my band name is my mother's maiden name and the street I grew up on. You know, it's some combination of those funny things, and people think they're hysterical. And then I said, so how many have you done one of these? And about 2/3 of the room put their hands up. Mm. I said, great. Now keep your hand up if you realize those are all challenge questions for your bank and you just gave the world the answer. Mother's maiden name, street you grew up on, first high school. These are all, you know, first car I owned. These are all challenge questions. And yet people sat there and just type them into Facebook, la-di-da, because they're terrible at it. And, you know, this is the problem. The problem is we have to be at a zero-trust model. But I was at a great conference that my friend Sal Fuentes did this panel in Fort Lauderdale earlier this week. And he was talking about buzzwords. You know, if you're in digital media and you're a publisher, which buzzword should you be paying attention to and which should you not? And he had his voting thumbs up, thumbs down. And one of them was Bitcoin. And I held up both thumbs up and thumbs down. I said, Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, probably not relevant to you. Blockchain, you have to be paying attention to. Because blockchain is the closest we are yet to building the correct data architecture for a distributed world.
I'm afraid we're not going to have time to get into blockchains. I talked about that with the previous guest a little bit.
Yeah. But when you talk about data and security, so. You know, it's I think there's somewhere in there is the right answer. And on how to build a topology that understands, you know, how you build identity and rights and security around it. We've reached this weird point where data has become quantum. And I don't mean quantum like quantum physics. I mean quantum that when data is created, it's secure and unsecure at the same time. And you don't decide which of those it is until the moment of query.
Oh, yeah. Give me an example of that.
Okay, so example is your cat dies, and you put up a picture of your cat on Facebook, and you say, you know, happy trails, Mr. Mittens. Is that secure data? No, it's not. It's Mr. Mittens is within a context called Facebook and a query called one of your followers. So in that ledger, basically, that's cool. They can look at it. Now, what we just said, we just talked about bank challenge questions. What's the name of your first cat? Mm-hmm. That is now what was 1 second ago in a query called Facebook, now in a query called your bank account, what was unsecure, Mr. Mittens, suddenly is secure because it's the answer to that challenge question.
The Facebook profile is a security key into your entire life.
Right. So security is derived not at the moment of creation, but at the moment of consumption.
Right.
And blockchain has got some great levers for that.
How do people think about that in their everyday life? They're so busy paying bills and watching Netflix. We don't think about
don't.
Those things.
And
that's
they shouldn't
why I do
have
these
to.
Shows.
They shouldn't have to. I mean, that's the problem is if we have become, all of us have become, we inherit the responsibility of being the CIOs of our own data. That's a horrible world we're going to live in.
Yeah.
And that can't be the world.
Well, hopefully people like you and your company are going to solve some of those problems in a small way and grow and grow. So I appreciate the insights that you've brought and the things that you're trying to do at Equifax. You're a very, very eloquent speaker of the whole situation, more so than anybody I've run into. So it's delightful to have you on the show.
We have to get you out more, John.
Well, I guess that's true. That's why I do these things. I learn so much from my guests. So anyway, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us and telling us about your life in Equifax. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. Thank you very much.
Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Sure. You can either find me at Christopher.Cain, that's C-A-E-N, Christopher.Cain at Equifax.com, or you can find me on Twitter at Citizen Cain, and again, C-A-E-N, Citizen Cain.
Cute. All right. Well, thanks, folks, for coming by, and I hope you enjoyed this week's show. You've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you next week.